I was going to try and do Palm Sunday today, but I was just kind of, I'm kind of tired of Luke. We've been there for 48 weeks. I'm tired of picking up the book and reading Luke and all. So when anytime I get that way, or if I'm someplace and I need to kill some time, and I know that's a horrible way to say it, I need to fill some time, I'll open up like John's Gospel and read, because I really enjoy John's Gospel, and it's a comfortable place for me. And you know, I could read the whole thing in about 45 minutes. I can get through it. So going to like physical therapy, standard, sitting around waiting in the doctor's offices, it's easy, right? So I was reading when I was having problems figuring out what I was going to do for Palm Sunday. I was reading John's Gospel, and I hit John chapter 4, which is the woman at the well. And it's not a typical Easter, leading up to Easter passage, but I like it, so that's what you're getting today, okay? But I was reading it, and I was talking to somebody, and this woman has been ostracized from the community, right? And I got into a discussion with somebody about, how do you get ostracized from a church? How do you, there's a common joke around pastors that we all walk around with a list of people in our church who we would like to invite to attend another church. And I mean that in the best way possible, okay? But nobody here's on that list, okay? So don't worry, it's all everybody else. But how do you get on that list? And on Wednesday, we have Deeper, right? And we come here and we sit and have a meal, and we hang around like we like each other. And some people wear T-shirts, and they wear T-shirts like this, which says Bangor Liberty Friends Church, and, you know, it's got the Quaker Oats guy on it, right? Which this is what I saw. Well, I saw the Quaker Oats guy. And then they were like, are you sure? And I started looking, and I realized that my wife, who is on my list now, sent somebody a picture to put on that. No. So that's how you get on the list, okay? Of people who need to, who would like to invite you to go to New Providence next week. There. I imagine that'll happen. There's also magnets on the fridge downstairs. You can thank the Stafford family. They're the ones who put it all together and encourage people to participate in that nonsense and all. So I figured I'd just share that with you because you know, making fun of your pastor is okay and all, and your pastor making fun of himself is okay. So, and all. Okay. So sometimes you don't even know. You think you just came here today by chance, or you showed up at some other event by chance, and it was just something that popped up. And some of you might come here with family, and especially around Easter, you get the CEOs, the Christmas and Easter onlys that show up and all with their family because their mom drug them or their grandmother drug them or something like that. And they're just here, they're just here to get somebody off their back, okay? And some of you are listening to this, and your only thought is, I wish you'd hurry up so we could make it to the buffet. And I don't want to be late for the tip-off for the game or something like that. And I know what you're thinking because I've sat in the pews too and thought the same thing, okay? But what if it's not an accident that you're here? Or what if everything that happens in your life isn't really an accident, okay? What if your life has been one big collision course since the beginning with a specific day, a specific moment, a specific time, and a specific place? And that's really what you read about in the Gospels. The Gospels are a collection, especially when you're in John's Gospel. It's a collection of these collisions where broken and busted and wrecked lives collide with Christ. And in those moments, in these collisions, you see something wonderful happening. And that's really what you have at church as well. I mean, everybody in here has had a collision Maybe it's a low speed bump in a parking lot in comparison to others, but everybody's had a collision in their life with their Creator. No. And it's one story of individual events after another. No. In John chapter 4, Jesus is traveling, and in verse 4, it says he had to go through Samaria. He had to go through Samaria. Now, that doesn't really grab our attention when we read it. It just seems like, well, he had to go there to get wherever he was going, right? Like, a lot of times I have to drive through Albion to get to Marshalltown. There's no other reason to go to Albion, no, except you want to get to Marshalltown, right? But that's not necessarily the case. You do a little research on this, and you find out that the Jews, they didn't want to go through Samaria. And they would add days to their trip just to avoid going through the land of Samaria. They didn't want to meet Samaritans. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it was just a whole bunch of prejudice, a lot of hatred between the Jews and the Samaritans. And so when you read this, you think, well, maybe that's what it is, that Jesus had to go. It's communicating to the Jewish reader that he doesn't want to go there, but he had to. And there was no other choice. And maybe that's what it is. Kind of like if you asked a husband or a boyfriend, you know, what movie did you and your wife go see on your date night? He would not say, oh, we went to the movies and saw a nice little romantic comedy. That's not what he's going to say. If he's going to tell you he did that, he would add a word. He would say, I had to go to the theater and watch a romantic comedy. He would say, I had to. It's an important word for that guy to get into the sentence, because if he just says, I went to see this chick flick, that's kind of awkward. And the other five guys standing around in the circle would kind of snicker and walk away and get in their own circle and make fun of the guy. It's awkward for everybody. And you suddenly wish you wouldn't have asked him what he did on his date, but if he says, I had to, it communicates something. It communicates that he didn't want to, he was forced to. Which is a lot of marriage. If he could have had another option, he would have taken that, but he had to. I think for the Jewish reader, that's how they hear this. But as you read the story, you pick up on it pretty quickly that Jesus isn't forced to do that. If anything, it seems that he went out of his way to go to Samaria. It seems like he had to go, more in the sense that he had an appointment that he had to keep. It's more like that. More that he looked on a calendar and he saw that he was supposed to be at a specific place at a specific time, and he had to get there because that's what was on the calendar, to see a specific person. In John chapter 4, when you read this, it's about noon when he gets there, and he comes to this well, and Jesus sits down and he rests while the disciples go into town and get some food. And it's not a normal place for, at that time, to meet someone at a well in the heat of the day, because the women typically would come to the well early in the morning when it was cool, or perhaps late in the evening when it was cool, but never in the heat of the day. Never, because the heat of the day in May, June, in that part of the world is 125 degrees. And they're all wearing wool, so it's a little bit hotter than that. But sure enough, one woman, just happens to come and to get some water. And it's also unusual that she would come by herself, because in those days, women would go, they go as a group. It's kind of like the way women go to the bathroom when you go out. They can't go by themselves. They have to take a pack with them. It's just a cultural thing. And it's kind of a community thing. Everybody would get together, and that would be going up to get water, and that's a social hour. You can talk about things going on and what's going on in the community. And so they would go as a community together in the morning, and so it's unusual that she's by herself in the heat of the day. And when she arrives, Jesus asks her for a drink, and she wasn't sure how to respond, because here's a Jewish man talking to her, asking her for a drink, and that wasn't done. Because no Jewish man, especially a Jewish rabbi, would just start talking to a random woman, ever. It's just not how things work. So in verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, you're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman, so how can you ask me for a drink? In verse 10, Jesus answers her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. And now she's really confused because she doesn't understand what he's talking about. Because now he's just a strange guy at a well talking about living water. And she's thinking in terms of a physical water for her physical thirst. But you get the sense that she's used to dealing with people who she doesn't really like and who don't like her and she doesn't really understand. And if you were reading John's Gospel in the previous chapter, in chapter 3, Nicodemus kind of does the same thing. Nicodemus is a religious leader and he goes to see Jesus at night and they're talking and Jesus tells him about being born again. And Nicodemus is talking about a man entering back into the womb of his mother and being born, and he doesn't understand what Jesus is talking about. Because Jesus is talking about the spiritual and not the physical, the literal idea. But this woman's used to this. She's used to these weird, uncomfortable, awkward encounters with people. So she says, kind of in a sarcastic way, you don't even have a bucket to draw water from. What are you even talking about? And Jesus says, well, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a living water. And if you drink of this water, you'll never thirst again. And she's just not following it. So Jesus decides to become a little bit more personal and direct with her. And in verse 16, he says to her, go call your husband and come back. And she says, I have no husband. And Jesus says, you're right. You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had five of them. And the man you now have, the man you're now living with, isn't your husband. What you said is true. Well, this is just one awkward moment on top of another. And she's not getting more comfortable at all. And we don't always acknowledge this, but part of being... A lot of people, when they pick this part of John's Gospel to make a point about other things, other social issues, like, and this is the easy one, if you have people who are same-sex attraction, and they live in that lifestyle, and they say, well, you know, Jesus didn't beat the woman over at the well over the head about anything. He just loved her and he was concerned about her. And that's true, but he did confront her about her sin. He did say what you're doing isn't right or isn't okay. And I think we lose this. We don't always acknowledge this, but part of being a caring and a loving person and watching out for the people around you is being truthful. And sometimes being blunt and sometimes making them uncomfortable. I'm not saying every conversation you have with a person should be that, but sometimes you have to. Sometimes you have to speak a little bit of that truth and light into their lives. And they might not like it, and that's fine. And you might both be uncomfortable. But even Jesus, he's not mean or ugly about this. He's not overly aggressive, and he doesn't step away from the truth. And he lets her know that he sees her for who she is. Not, I see you as a sinful person, but I see you for, you know, you're a person who's just lived a life. And we've all lived lives, right? We've not all made perfect decisions. We've not all made, you know, we don't all live a perfect life. Or maybe you're there now, but, you know, maybe that time span between when you were 18 and 30, or 18 and 24, or 18 and 50, whatever. Maybe that wasn't perfect, and there were lots of mistakes and missteps, and you know, there were times when you went to the well at noon in the heat of the day because you didn't want to see anybody. But he lets her know that he sees her for who she is. He knows the reality of what she's done in her life and the condition that life has left her in. And he knows she needs to start finding another well to draw water from, because the well of relationships is not quenching the thirst she has in her life, because that's not working for her. And just like when we encounter Jesus, we encounter the truth about ourselves. I mean, you can't come in contact with, really understand Jesus and not really understand who and what you are. Jesus points out our failed relationships. What would he point out about you and me? Maybe he would say your drinking's gotten out of control. It's affecting more people than just you. Maybe he would say the secret sin, that secret thing you carry around, is taking you to a place you don't really want to go. Or maybe you would say your next promotion, the newest electronic device, the new car, the new house, the new golf club, none of those things are going to quench that thirst, that need that you have inside of you. And you're not going to find what you're looking for in that well. He might say that. He does that for this woman, and the whole encounter is all uncomfortable. And I think she probably felt the way some of us feel in our lives. For her part, the woman responds the same way many of us do when we're confronted with the truth about ourselves. And we try to avoid it. We do our best to look or turn the other way. And here she tries to steer him and the conversation in a different direction. So when Jesus confronts her with her life, she turns and says in verse 19, "Sir, I can see that you're a prophet." Or other translations say, "I perceive that you're a prophet. And our ancestors worshipped this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem." So to avoid this awkwardness, this uncomfortable spot in her life, she turns the conversation towards religion and interpretive differences and dogma and that sort of thing, the stuff we like to argue over on Wednesday nights. And we do that quite a bit in our lives, not just on Wednesday nights, but every day. Jesus gets a little bit too personal and a little bit too close and starts poking around at us and starts exposing things. And we get really religious and we start talking about, you know, something else. Something steps on our toes and suddenly we want to debate, you know, your view of the end times, or are you a Calvinist or an Arminian, or you know, what are those Seventh-day Adventists doing? And can't we do something about the Mormons? Yeah. We have this conversation, I think every year at yearly meeting we have this conversation. We're talking, the William Penn, President William Penn comes in and he gives a report on the school, and we talk about that, and there's always somebody in there who wants to bring up, well, you know, John Addison, he's a Mormon. And what's that got to do with William Penn and how we interact with William Penn? You know. But anyway, we try and sidetrack the conversation. And I see this sometimes after a sermon where it'll be perhaps confronting to someone's life, and suddenly they want to talk about where I stand on some other issue. And they have some theory, some doctrinal theory. And I have a theory as well. My theory is that the more caught up and obsessed people are over areas that clearly fall under this umbrella of interpretation and opinion, because there's a lot of things in the Bible that you can have just an opinion about. You don't have to, not everybody has to agree on this, okay? You can have, there's freedom to have an opinion and to think differently. The more they concentrate on those things, the more they're trying to keep Jesus from getting too personal in some area of their lives, because something else is getting too close and making things uncomfortable. So they sidetrack it and they go talk about something else. So I used to get drawn off sides by this a lot. Facebook used to be fun with this, and emails, and someone would email me and go off on some interpretive detail and that they felt like I missed in a sermon, and I'd fire off an email and defend my interpretation. We go back and forth, and we start talking about something that doesn't really matter. And I try not to do that too much anymore. I'm not saying I never do it. If you want to try, we can do it. That's fine. I mean, Monday's my day off, and I like sitting around doing stuff like that. Because here's what I've learned. When someone is especially just determined to talk about religion and religiosity and to talk about interpretation, a lot of times it's because they don't want to talk about themselves and what God is doing in their lives, or what God, or the direction God is trying to point them in. And they're avoiding a more personal encounter, a more personal collision that really needs to take place. So I think that's true for this woman. She's made some assumptions about Jesus that are causing her to do her best to avoid him. Assumption number one is that he'll want nothing to do with her. And just as the Samaritan woman saw Jesus as a Jewish man who wouldn't want to talk to her, some of you, some of the people we come in contact feel the same way. It's just that you don't think he would want anything to do with you, because I've done horrible things in my life, and you don't know how bad I am, or something like that. Another assumption she made is that he's more interested in religion than he is in my life. Or number three is that he's making an offer that's too good to be true, and the church is guilty of that sometimes. We talk to people and we're like, hey, come and join the church and all your problems will go away, and you'll never have, there'll no be no more stress in your life or anything like that. And that's nothing but a lie, because Jesus never promised us that. And we're trying to paint Christianity as something and faith in Christ as something that it's really not. But here he's offering living water that she'll never thirst again. And here's a woman who has been made all kinds of promises by all kinds of men in her life. And she's skeptical and she's cynical and she knows better, because her heart's been hardened. And I know I'd use this to talk about how, what men have done to her, but women do the same thing to men. And, you know, we do it to each other. And, you know, none of us are the best people in the world. And so she makes these assumptions about Jesus that caused her to initially do her best to avoid him. And here's the reality. Some of you are resisting Jesus and his pull on your life and his call because you made the same assumptions about him that aren't even true. And maybe it was the church you grew up in. Maybe it was the home you grew up in. Maybe it was something from your past. But you've made these assumptions about Jesus and the church and faith, and it just causes you to resist what you're being pulled towards. And the thing is, you're not resisting the real Jesus, you're resisting the one that you've assumed into existence. Because the Jesus maybe I'm not talking to you as an individual, and I'm talking to you as this is what you have to deal with when you talk to other people about the gospel. These are the people you come in contact with, and this is what they've built up. Okay? So take it that way. If you're sitting there going, I don't have these assumptions, okay? But the people you come in contact with, the people you talk about Christ with, they will have these assumptions. And it's not the real Jesus they're resisting. It's the one they've assumed into existence. They're resisting the assumed Jesus. And if you're going to reject Jesus, we need to make sure that you're rejecting the real one, not the one that we've created in our heads. And so Jesus addresses this with her. In verse 19, she refers to him as a prophet. People at that time believed that a prophet was able to see your past or knew the secret sin that you had in your life. Think about Nathan when he confronted David following the encounter with Bathsheba. And David, he's killed off Bathsheba's husband, and everything's fine, and nobody knows, and it's just a secret between David and Bathsheba. And Nathan comes in and describes the whole thing to him, and David's, you know, he's caught out, and he's like, I don't know what to do. And that's the way people saw prophets then. And you can read a lot about this at home, but eventually the woman, I think, she just really doesn't know what to say or how to respond, so she tries to draw a conclusion to this conversation. So here's what she says. Verse 25, she says, I know that the Messiah called Christ when he comes, he'll explain everything to us. And that's what she says. I know that you don't know the answers to these questions either, but when the Messiah comes, he'll know the answers. And I don't know, and I could be wrong, but I think Jesus probably heard that and he probably smiled to himself. You know? And we do the same thing. I mean, how many times have we said, Wednesday was a good example. We talked about a little bit of everything on Wednesday night in our class. And eventually we got to the round of the point where, you know, we're talking about stuff that we there's no way we can possibly have the answer to this. I cannot sit here definitively and say this is the answer to that question. And there's lots of those that you won't know until you're on the other side and you're able to ask somebody who knows. Okay? But this is an interpretive way of saying, well, we have to agree to disagree. Which is an annoying thing to say to people when you're talking to them. Eventually, actually what she's saying is, well, nobody really knows yet, but we'll know eventually. which is just putting, kicking the can down the road, putting everything off. But he's smiling at this. He had to be smiling at this. And Jesus says in verse 26, I, the one speaking to you, I'm that person. I am him. This is the only time in his entire life where he so voluntarily and so candidly just says, yes, that's me. I am the Son of God. I'm the Messiah. And it's to a Samaritan woman in a part of the world the Jews didn't want anything to do with. A woman with a bad reputation coming to this collision that she never saw coming. I mean, who's expecting that? And why does he pick this woman to do that? But that's usually the way these things go. Nothing really makes sense when we look at it, because we're trying to wrap our brain around it. And if our brain could wrap around it, then, I mean, we would be God. If you think you can understand why God is doing this and how God is doing this, then your conception of God isn't the right conception, because your God is so much bigger than that. So anyway, Jesus is on his collision course with her life, and I'm just wondering if it hasn't happened already, if that isn't something that's waiting on each of us. And if you're on the fast track to an encounter with Jesus, you can expect, there's a few things you can expect. First, you can expect that if he's really coming to collide with your life, he's going to be on a collision course with the lies that you believed about yourself. I mean, the fact this woman comes in the heat of the day by herself, and it just shows how she saw herself. I don't know if it was husband number 2 or 3 or 1 through 3 or all 5, but at some point she had pretty much gotten the idea that she wasn't really worth a lot. And the men in her life, my guess is, had devalued her and objectified her in some way, and she didn't feel like she was worth a whole lot. And that's not how Jesus sees her. It's not how Jesus sees you, and it's not how he sees me. Because if Jesus is going to collide with your life, he's going to collide with your past mistakes. And he tells this woman that he knows about the past. And that's scary for us. We don't like talking about that. I mean, it's the oddball individual that wants to come out and say, hey, this is what I did stupid in my life over the last 40 years. And some of us have really long lists. And some of you might not have very long lists at all, okay? But anyway, that's scary. Whether your list has 20 things or one, we don't want to expose all that to just everybody. We don't want people to know about it. So she goes to this well when no one else is going to see her, no one else is going to be there to talk about her, and we do our best to avoid Jesus. And it's kind of like that when you owe money on a bill and you don't have the money to pay for it. You don't pick up the phone when the collection agency calls, and you owe money to a person, and you do your best, you know, to walk around them and to avoid them. And so for many of us, it's how we handle Jesus. But here's the thing, Jesus, he just keeps coming. He's like in some ways, he's like the collection agency. They don't stop calling. They just keep calling. They keep knocking. But in this instance, he's not calling to collect. He's not calling to get anything from you. He's calling to let you know that it's all been paid for, that you can be free, that you don't have to live like that anymore, like this anymore, that you don't have to stay in the darkness. You don't have to have shame and guilt as your constant companion. And I know for all of us, we think the worst thing that could happen to us is for our secret sin, our secret whatever, to be found out. And we don't want anybody to know, right? But that's not the worst thing. The worst thing is you go through months or years of your life and nobody knows, and you just carry that weight around with you. Because it doesn't get lighter over time. It just seems to collect. And you just carry this weight. And the whole time Jesus is saying, just give that to me. Just let me have that. And it takes courage, and it takes a lot of courage that if you've been living in the dark, to step all the way into the light. And I know that. And all I'm saying is there's freedom in that light. There's freedom in being known by him. This woman at the well resisted Jesus for as long as she could, but he wouldn't stop. And he just kept talking. There's a story about Mary Dwyer, who was a Quaker back in the 1600s. And Mary wouldn't shut up, okay? She wouldn't stop talking. And she got ran out of Boston a couple of times, and she wouldn't quit. She just kept coming back, and she kept coming back. And finally, the people in Boston, the religious leaders in Boston, said, okay, you're not going to leave? We're going to hang you. And then she didn't leave. And so they hung her. But she wouldn't stop talking. And it's the same way with Jesus. He won't stop. And finally, it seems she's going to be let off the hook, because now the 12 disciples show back up after going in town to get some food. We're in verse 27. But she's gone through a pretty dramatic and relatively quick transformation here, seeing herself and all this. And she doesn't go back to drawing water when the disciples come. Instead, she leaves the water jar, or the two water jars, or however many water jars she had. And she goes back into town. In fact, she goes back into town to the very people who would have shunned her for these many years. And she goes to the very people she was trying to avoid by going to the well in the heat of the day. And she goes to them, and she says in verse 29, come and see a man who told me all that I have ever done. Can this be the Christ? I mean, the first question that pops up when you say something like that is, well, what have you ever done? What is he telling you about? I mean, because we like the TV show, and we like all the gossip and all the news. But because of this verse in 30, it says they all followed her out of the town and were coming to Jesus. Now, there had to be something about her other than just the word she said that convinced these people. I mean, there had to be some change in her appearance, in the way she carried herself, in something that made these people actually look at her and see her differently and want to go see this person that she'd run into. And you know what I'm talking about. Some people go through things and they come out the other side and they look different. And it's the way they carry themselves, the way they talk, the way they walk. For the Samaritan woman, the guilt and the shame of her past had been eclipsed by the fact that she had met the Messiah. She had met the Creator. And Jesus has brought this woman to a point that I think we all find ourselves at sometime in our lives. We all start life as essentially a donut, okay? And there's this big hole missing from the very center of our existence. And throughout our lives, we spend time, money, everything we have, trying to fill that hole, that void that's inside of us. And we are all so much like the Samaritan woman. She spent a good part of her life moving from one relationship to another, expecting that other person to fill that hole that she knows is there. And for this woman, it was the belief that a relationship would change her life. And what is it for us? Have we chased after physical relationships and belief that another person, the next person, would make us whole, only to find that the other person is just as damaged and just as lost and just as broken as we are? I was talking to Joe earlier. We were talking about Saturday Night Live. You know, the one year in history that Saturday Night Live was funny was 1978. And Dan Aykroyd was on there. I've talked about this a lot. Dan Aykroyd was on there talking about, you know, Halloween treats that they had for sale. And you had a bag of razor blades. And one of them was a bag of crushed glass. Well, you and I are bags of crushed glass, okay? And we bounce off of each other, and the crushed glass cuts us inside, and we cut each other as well. And that's basically what we do to each other. This woman believed this relationship could change everything for her. But the next relationship was just as bad as the one before. Maybe different, but it was bad. But the relationship that was going to save us becomes a hostile living environment where we're two jagged, lethal, hurting people bouncing off of each other, becoming more hurt and feeling that big, empty donut just getting bigger and bigger? Have we chased money under the mistaken belief that money could buy us the thing that we most want or that we most need? And when we don't find what we're looking for in our relationships or in money or our job, we tend to turn to something else to comfort us. And we drink a little to escape the pain or emptiness that we feel. And we turn to food because food is a great comforter. I've never been rejected by ice cream. Plus, I'm always happy when I'm eating ice cream. I've never been unhappy eating ice cream. Never once in my life. And while eating enough ice cream will fill out your waistline, it will not fill that hole that exists in the center of the donut. All these other things we try to fill our life with are little more than a distraction from what our true desire is. Our true desire is to fill that empty hole at our center. Our true desire is to be made whole again. Our true desire is to be reconciled with the one who knows everything I've ever done. Because when that reconciliation takes place, gone is the hole, gone is the emptiness and the guilt and the shame of the life we led without God. And when that hole at our center is filled with the gift of the Holy Spirit dwelling within us, we're something new. We're, Paul said, we're a new creation. And it's this Spirit that John called the Paraclete, the one that comes alongside. This Spirit provides peace and understanding and truth and contentment. It is this that enables the woman to run back to share her experience with all those people who were not good for her life and shunned her and made her feel less than and marginalized and made her feel more comfortable in the heat of the day at a well by herself. It is this that enables us to love and to serve and to pray for and to share our lives with those who are around us, even the ones who are around us who we'd like to invite to attend a different church. This is what tells us beyond a doubt that we've been redeemed, that our lives will never be the same, and that our eternity is safely secured. It's this realization that collision that we had at some point in our lives that changed us and transformed us, not into, say, a good person, but the person that he's called us to be. Would you pray with me? Heavenly gracious Father, we are, in so many ways, we can see ourselves in this woman at the well, and we see ourselves just as she is. As maybe we haven't had five husbands or five wives or five relationships even, but we've definitely spent time searching for a different well, trying to run away from the people who know us, and trying to run away from who we know we are. And one day we had that encounter and we met you, and just like you never walk away from a traffic accident the same, we can never walk away from an encounter with the Creator without being different. And maybe we've got it figured out. We're not the woman at the well looking for answers, but we're the person at the well meeting somebody else that's come. And I pray, Lord, that you would help us to see that woman in the well in the people we come in contact with. That we would be loving and caring and share the good news with them and be honest with them and help them to see their relationship with their Creator in a more clear light, and they could fully understand the gospel and what their need is for that. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.